At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
As the Lindsay Clancy trial wrapped up this week, we heard from four experts. So this week, we're breaking down where they agree, where they don't, and the question that could decide everything. Who will the jury believe? This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we unravel complex court cases, investigations, and true crime stories. From high-profile trials to the mysteries that still leave questions unanswered. We examine the facts, weigh the evidence, and explore the arguments shaping each story, just as the jurors do. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is The Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lindsay Clancy, The Trial, Part 5. When we left off in the last episode, the defense was still building its case. But over the next few days, that case would quickly move toward its conclusion, with the final witnesses taking the stand and some of the most important testimony yet about Lindsay's state of mind that night. By the end of the week, the defense was down to its final two witnesses. But before either took the stand, something was happening outside the Plymouth County Courthouse that I think is worth talking about. On Thursday morning, more than 200 people gathered for Stand in Peace for Lindsay, a silent rally where people wore pink, held signs, prayed, or simply stood together. It was clearly a show of support for Lindsay, but organizers said the message was bigger than one defendant. It was raising awareness about postpartum mental illness and what they believe are failures in the mental health system that contributed to this tragedy. Now, none of this is in evidence, of course. In fact, jurors were individually questioned that morning to make sure that the rally had not affected their ability to remain impartial. But it does show just how far beyond this courtroom this case has reached. Because for many of the people standing outside, Lindsay Clancy has become part of a much bigger conversation about women asking for help, whether that help is enough, and what can happen when the severity of someone's illness isn't recognized until it's too late. Inside the courthouse, the defense was ready to call its final two witnesses. The first was Sheila Cavanaugh. Not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but a chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Cavanaugh first met Lindsay on January 25, 2023, the morning after the children were strangled. Lindsay was intubated and unable to speak, but Cavanaugh continued visiting, and after Lizzie was extubated, she remembers the first thing that Lindsay said to her. She said, "I'm so glad my children are safe." Cavanaugh told her that her children were safe, in heaven with God, and she held her hand and prayed with her. But what made Cavanaugh especially important to the defense? She also mentioned the voice. Now, we've talked about the prosecution's argument that Lindsay never reported a command hallucination before the killings, and that the detailed account of this voice comes later, after attorneys and experts became involved in her case. But Cavanaugh had been meeting with Lindsay before those defense experts ever evaluated her, and she testified that Lindsay told her about the voice.
She alluded to having heard a voice, and the voice, according to Lindsay, told her that if she did not follow the command, neither she nor her children would be safe.
And did she indicate whether it was a male voice, a female voice, loud, soft?
She alluded to the fact that it was a male voice and it was persistent.
Cavanaugh said that she visited Lindsay around 14 times during her stay at that hospital, and the voice came up during several of those visits. And that's what made this testimony significant. The defense now had an earlier account of the voice that did not originate in a forensic evaluation for this criminal case. That directly pushes back against the suggestion that Lindsay developed this story later. But on cross, prosecutors went straight for the weakness. If Lindsay had told her about this voice several times, why wasn't it in Cavanaugh's notes? Because Cavanaugh did document their visits. She wrote about Lindsay's fears that she might never walk again, concerns about being vulnerable because of her paralysis, her physical progress, and moments when she seemed hopeful. But she never documented the voice. Kavanaugh explained that the chaplain notes are not transcripts. She wasn't there to evaluate or diagnose Lindsay. As she put it, she was there to bear witness to her suffering. She also said chaplain conversations are understood to be private, and because she isn't a medical provider, she doesn't document medical conditions or make clinical assessments. So that leaves the jury with a credibility question. Do they believe Kavanaugh's memory of these conversations, despite the fact that the voice never appears in her notes? And then Sprague asked one more question, and this one made my jaw drop.
Did in those conversations with her at Spalding, did she tell you that how in those first weeks at Spalding, that part of her physical therapy, she was working out with a yellow exercise band? No?
I don't recall her telling me that.
The significance of that question is unmistakable. The children were killed with exercise bands, and one of those bands was yellow. Kavanaugh did not remember Lindsay telling her about it, but I don't think that her answer was really the point. The question was the point. In one sentence, prosecutors put an incredibly disturbing image in front of the jury. Lindsay Clancy, after killing her children with exercise bands, later using an exercise band during her own rehabilitation. The same type of object used to kill her children was now being used to rebuild her own body after the injuries that she sustained that night. Now, whether you see that as relevant to Lindsay's behavior afterward or primarily as an emotional reminder of what happened to Cora, Dawson, and Callan, it was a moment that landed. And then the defense called its final witness, Dr. Philip Resnick. And if the name sounds familiar, there's a reason for that. Resnick is a forensic psychiatrist who has been studying filicide, the killing of a child by a parent, for decades. He evaluated Andrea Yates and testified in her case, and over the course of his career has been involved in some of the country's most high-profile criminal cases, including Jeffrey Dahmer, Casey Anthony, Ted Kaczynski, and the Oklahoma City bombing. So this wasn't just another psychiatrist taking the stand. The defense was ending its case with someone who has spent much of his career studying the exact intersection at the center of this trial: severe mental illness, psychosis, and parents who kill their children. And unlike some of the experts that we've heard from, Resnick evaluated Lindsay relatively close to the crime, about 4 months after the children died in 2023. He spent roughly 3 hours with Lindsay, another hour and a half with her parents, and reviewed extensive medical records, police reports, and other evidence available to him. He described Lindsay during that evaluation as cooperative, but with a flat or muted effect. She was medicated at the time, and although nurses reported that she cried daily over the loss of her children, Resnick said that she was able to give him a detailed account of what she remembered happening that night. After reviewing all of that information, Resnick reached a diagnosis.
So my final diagnosis of her was called bipolar 2 with a severe depression on January 24, 2023.
Dr. Resnick, who had recently had surgery, had to testify via Zoom. So the audio isn't the greatest, but in case you missed that, his final diagnosis of Lindsay was bipolar 2 disorder with severe depression and postpartum onset. He walked the jury through the progression that we've been talking about throughout this trial. Some anxiety after her first child, more significant symptoms after her second, and then severe anxiety and depression following Callan's birth. And Resnick believed that that deterioration ultimately culminated in psychosis. In his opinion, on January 24th, 2023, Lindsay Clancy was, quote-unquote, frankly psychotic.
After time of the crime itself, on January 24, 2023, Ms. Clancy was frankly psychotic. So in that sense, she had a postpartum psychosis. It's actually not frequent to have a postpartum psychosis 8 months after a birth, but it does occasionally occur. And so what I can say is whether it is a classic postpartum psychosis or not, with the postpartum onset and frank psychosis on the day of the killing, I would label that a postpartum psychosis in the sense that it was a postpartum onset and she was clearly psychotic on that day.
But Resnick didn't just tell the jury that Lindsay was psychotic. He explained what he believed that psychosis actually looked like. According to Resnick, Lindsay experienced a command hallucination, a voice directing her to kill the children. And he said that there was something else happening at that same time, what he called a delusion of influence. Lindsay described feeling as though an outside force had taken control of her body, almost like she was a puppet and someone else was pulling the strings. And that distinction becomes important, because hearing a voice doesn't automatically mean that someone has to obey it. Resnick acknowledged that people can resist command hallucinations. His opinion was that Lindsay believed she couldn't. Resnick then brought his decades of research on filicide directly into this case. He told the jury that he had identified five general categories of why parents kill their children. One would be an unwanted child, one would be revenge against a spouse, and another would be fatal maltreatment or abuse. And he said none of those applied to Lindsay. But there were two that he believed did apply to Lindsay. The first was acutely psychotic filicide, a parent who is so disconnected from reality that the killing occurs within that psychotic state. But the second is probably even more important to understanding the defense's theory. That one is altruistic filicide. That's when a parent kills not because they hate their child, but because their distorted thinking convinces them that killing the child is somehow in the child's best interest. Resnick believed that Lindsay had become convinced that she was going to die and that her children could not continue without her. In that psychotic framework, he said, she believed that they would be better off in heaven with her as opposed to alive without her. And that gives the defense an answer to one of the hardest questions in this entire case. How does a mother that everyone describes as loving her children suddenly kill all three of them? Resnick's answer was essentially that, in Lindsay's psychotic reality, those two things were not contradictory. She believed that she was saving them. And legally, that would matter. Because remember, the question for this jury isn't whether Lindsay had a mental illness. Under Massachusetts law, the issue is whether, because of a mental disease or defect, she lacked the substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality or wrongfulness of what she was doing, or to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. And this is where Resnick ultimately landed. To a reasonable degree of medical certainty, he concluded that Lindsay lacked the substantial capacity to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. In other words, according to Resnick, she wasn't just hearing a voice and choosing to follow it. She was experiencing a command hallucination that she believed she was powerless to resist, combined with a delusional belief that killing her children was somehow protecting them. And he pointed to what happened immediately afterward as part of that same picture. Lindsay cut her wrist and neck and then went out the second story window in what Resnick believed was a genuine attempt to die. And then there was another issue that Resnick addressed that we've heard over and over throughout this trial. Was Lindsay exaggerating or fabricating psychiatric symptoms after the killings? Resnick has written extensively on malingering. In fact, even prosecution experts relied on his published work. But he pointed to something interesting in the Commonwealth's own psychological testing. The MMPI is the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. It's a standardized psychological test used to assess personality, mental health symptoms, and whether someone's responses appear consistent and credible. The MMPI, administered by the Commonwealth's expert Dr. Heilbrunn, did not suggest that Lindsay was exaggerating psychiatric symptoms. In fact, it suggested the opposite. According to Resnick, the testing showed a tendency to minimize symptoms rather than exaggerate them, with no indication that she was faking psychiatric illness. And he believed that that fit the history. Lindsay could appear relatively functional to people who didn't know her well, while telling the people closest to her just how badly she was struggling. There was, however, one thing that she wasn't fully disclosing: her thoughts of harming the children. Resnick believed that Lindsay concealed those because she had become irrationally afraid that if anyone knew, her children would be taken away. And when the defense finished with Dr. Resnick, they had essentially put their entire theory of this case into one major expert opinion. Lindsay Clancy was severely mentally ill. Her illness had progressed into psychosis. She heard a command to kill her children, believed an outside force had taken control of her, and simultaneously believed that her children could not survive without her. And because of that mental disease, Resnick believed that on January 24th, Lindsey Clancy lacked the capacity to conform her behavior to the law. And with that, the defense rested. We'll be right back.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough, stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The defense rested with a pretty clear answer to the central question in this case. According to Dr. Resnick, Lindsey Clancy killed her children because she was psychotic, hearing a command that she believed she could not resist while operating under a delusional belief that her children would be better off dead with her than alive without her. And because of that mental disease, Resnick believed that she could not conform her conduct to the law. Now, once the defense rested, prosecutors began calling their rebuttal experts, psychiatrist Dr. Avram Mack, psychologist Dr. Kirk Heilbrunn, and finally psychiatrist Dr. Gregory Sathoff. And this is where things get a little more complicated, because it's not as simple as Dr. Resnick on one side and all three prosecution experts on the other. The prosecution's experts don't agree with each other on everything. And they don't disagree with Dr. Resnick on everything either. So before we get into where these four experts differ, and those differences are important, I think that we first need to look at what they actually agree on. Because there are some pretty significant points where, despite ultimately reaching different conclusions, all four experts are essentially on the same page. They all recognize that Lindsey was experiencing significant psychiatric problems in the months leading up to January 24th. They recognize the depression, anxiety, severe problems with sleep, suicidal thinking, intrusive thoughts, and the increasingly desperate attempts to find medications that would make her feel better. Even the Commonwealth's experts acknowledge that she was sick and suffered from a mental disease or defect. All four experts also agree that Lindsey's attempt to take her own life was a serious one. I thought that was an interesting point given the way that the prosecutors have spent the entire trial suggesting otherwise. They may interpret why she did it differently, but they agree that she was genuinely trying to die. And there's one more point that I want to highlight because this one goes directly back to something that prosecutors said during opening statements.
This was a woman who no longer liked the life she thought she wanted. It was getting harder and harder to control. And when she saw the opportunity to escape, she made the selfish choice to take it.
That was the theory that prosecutors gave this jury at the beginning of this trial. Lindsey was controlling, motherhood had become harder to control, she didn't want the life that she thought she wanted anymore, and she made a selfish choice to escape it and take her children with her. But here's what's interesting. The Commonwealth's own expert, Dr. Heilbrunn, ultimately gave them a very different explanation for why Lindsay would take the children with her. When trying to explain why a suicidal mother who loved her children would kill them before killing herself, Hybern's explanation was essentially that Lindsay believed her children needed her and would not be okay without her. In other words, even one of the prosecution's own experts wasn't describing this as, "Yeah, I don't want these kids anymore. I want out." He was describing something much closer to, "I'm going to die and I can't leave my children behind."
Altruistic filicide is a term that's used that means killing your kids out of love, not because you're trying to be cruel or for material gain or because you want them out of your lives or any of that, but killing them out of love so that you could basically they wouldn't have to suffer, so you could prevent their suffering. One of the things that she said when asked about what happened is that in the course of strangling each child, she said, "Go to God, baby, go to God." And that was part of her expectation that she and the children would be together in heaven with God.
That distinction was interesting because Heilbrunn may disagree with Resnick about whether that belief was psychotic, but the two actually come much closer on the underlying motivation. This wasn't about Lindsay being selfish or simply wanting to escape motherhood. It was tied to her attachment to her children and her belief that they could not continue on without her. Even when prosecutors continued to push the selfish narrative and suggest that Lindsay was moving forward without a care in the world because she was talking about her future or how the future might look for her, Heilbrunn pushed back again.
Don't think that she was in any way over this or thinking only about herself. It's something that I noticed when I evaluated her in April, is that she is still grieving. She's still in mourning for those kids. And she used language like, "I have lost everything and I don't want to be here."
This seemed like yet another area where prosecutors really missed the mark on what theories they were presenting to the jury. Despite them not really agreeing with the prosecutors, there is actually a lot of common ground here between the experts. But obviously, they don't reach the same ultimate conclusion on everything. And to understand how four experts can look at much of the same evidence and end up in such different places, we need to start pulling apart exactly where their opinions diverge. And I think the easiest place to start is with the most basic question. What was Lindsay Clancy actually suffering from? Because, interestingly, the Commonwealth's experts don't even agree on her diagnosis. When the defense's expert, Dr. Resnick, took the stand, he testified to what he believed Lindsay's diagnosis to be.
So my final diagnosis of her was called bipolar 2 with a severe depression.
Two of the Commonwealth's experts actually agreed on the bipolar diagnosis, Dr. Heilbrunn and Dr. Saithoff. But their other expert, Dr. Mack, gave a different diagnosis.
My opinion about her diagnosis in the span from 2022 to 2023 is that she suffered from what's called a major depressive episode. That probably is a part of what's called a major depressive disorder, but the important point about it is the major depressive episode.
Dr. Mack may not agree with the bipolar diagnosis, but Lindsay's treating physicians at Tewksbury do. They are currently treating her for bipolar disorder, including with medications used to treat bipolar disorder. Dr. Resnick believed that Lindsay showed evidence of earlier hypomania, combined with a severe depressive episode. He connected that illness to a postpartum onset and ultimately postpartum psychosis. Dr. Saithoff agreed that Lindsay had bipolar 2 disorder and argued that that diagnosis made the most sense given Lindsay's symptoms historically. He specifically considered her severe insomnia following Zoloft very significant. Heilbrunn admitted that he initially struggled to identify a clear hypomanic period, but what ultimately pushed him toward bipolar 2 was Lindsay's later diagnosis and treatment at Tewksbury and her response to mood stabilizing treatment. But the disagreement over diagnosis is only the beginning. That leads us into the much bigger question in this case.
psychosis.
We'll be right back.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Whether you call Lindsay's underlying illness bipolar disorder, major depressive disorder, or something else, the question that matters most for January 24th is, was she experiencing psychosis when she killed her children? And this is where the experts really begin to separate. Because Dr. Resnick, of course, says yes. He believes Lindsay was acutely psychotic that evening. He believes the external male voice that she described was a genuine command hallucination, and that her feeling that an outside force had taken control of her body was a delusion of influence. In his opinion, she wasn't simply hearing a voice and deciding to obey it. She believed that she had no ability to resist it. The prosecution experts see that evidence very differently. But, and this is important, they don't necessarily say that what Lindsay described couldn't be psychosis. In fact, Heilbrunn acknowledged that an external voice commanding someone to do something can absolutely be a psychotic symptom. His issue was whether he believed Lindsay's particular account represented a genuine command hallucination. So now the disagreement becomes a little bit more narrow. It isn't whether command hallucinations are real or whether or not someone can hear an external voice telling them to kill. The real disagreement is, did that actually happen to Lindsay on January 24th? And that's where we have to look at why Resnick believes her, and why the Commonwealth experts don't. And this is where I think it helps to take them one at a time, because they're looking at many of the same facts, but giving those facts very different weight. Dr. Resnick believes Lindsay was psychotic on January 24th because he accepts her report that she heard a loud external male voice commanding her to kill the children and then herself. He also believes her description that she felt like a puppet, as though an outside force had taken control of her body, was a delusion of influence. And Resnick didn't look at the voice in isolation. He connected it to her deteriorating mental health, suicidality, intrusive thoughts about the children, her fear that the children would be taken away, and her belief that they could not survive without her. For Resnick, those pieces fit together. And his conclusion was that Lindsay was acutely psychotic and believed that she was powerless to resist the command. Dr. Mack disagrees. He diagnosed Lindsay with major depressive disorder, with anxiety and obsessive thinking, but he did not believe she was psychotic. One of the biggest problems for Mack was the timing of the alleged voice. According to Lindsay, this was the first time that she had ever heard this particular external voice. It appeared after Patrick left, and she has not reported hearing it again. Mack also focused heavily on her behavior that evening. He viewed what she did as organized and goal-directed, including what happened to the children and then her attempt to take her own life. So Mack doesn't necessarily dispute that Lindsay was severely depressed and suicidal, but he disputes that leap from severe mental illness to psychosis.
Then we get to Dr. Heilbrun, and I think his opinion is especially interesting because he lays out the competing possibilities pretty clearly. He acknowledges that there is evidence that could support psychosis. Lindsay described an external male voice, which he agrees can be an auditory hallucination. There were also other experiences in the record that could potentially point toward psychotic thinking. But ultimately, Heilbrun did not believe that the evidence was strong enough to conclude that Lindsay was psychotic.
The two options that you considered, that this was psychosis with command hallucinations or suicide with altruistic filicide, is your testimony that it's either or it's one or the other?
It's my testimony that those were the two possibilities that seemed to have some evidence. But at the end of talking to her, testing, reviewing all the information, doing the collateral interviews, everything I did as a part of this evaluation, the evidence much more strongly, in my opinion, supported the second explanation, which was the serious suicide attempt accompanied by killing the children out of love.
A major reason was the distinction between what Lindsay reported before January 24th and what she reported afterward. In December, she described disturbing thoughts about killing herself and sometimes harming the children. But Heilbrun interpreted those as intrusive thoughts originating inside of her own mind, not external auditory hallucinations. So for Heilbrun, the external male voice on January 24th stands out because it is different from what appears in the months of records before it. And then there's Dr. Sethoff. Like Mack and Heilbrun, he ultimately did not accept that Lindsay was experiencing psychosis that caused the killings. But he also acknowledged some important things on cross-examination. He agreed that voices can be experienced as internal or external, and he acknowledged that the voice that Lindsay described to him during the killings was external. And that brings us back to what I think is the central divide between these four experts. They're basically fighting over how to interpret Lindsay's account of what happened. Resnick looks at the totality of her deterioration and says, yep, this was psychosis. The voice was real to her. But the Commonwealth's experts look at the absence of clearly documented hallucinations before January 24th, and then the sudden appearance of this external voice at the exact moment that Patrick leaves, and Lindsay's organized behavior, and they say, we're not convinced. And that leaves the jury with an incredibly important question. Is the lack of a documented hallucination before January 24th evidence that the voice wasn't real? Or could January 24th simply have been the first time that her illness crossed that line? Because after all of that, the different diagnoses, the different interpretations of psychosis, the different interpretations of the voice, we finally get to the question that actually matters legally. Because remember, Lindsay can be severely mentally ill. She can be suicidal. She can even have bipolar disorder. But none of those things, by themselves, make her not criminally responsible. The question is whether, because of a mental disease or defect, she lacked the substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality or wrongfulness of what she was doing, or to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. And on that question, Resnick stands apart from the three Commonwealth experts. Dr. Resnick says that Lindsay was not criminally responsible. His opinion is specifically that Lindsay lacked the substantial capacity to conform her conduct to the law. Put all of that together, and Resnick's opinion is essentially this. Lindsay killed her children because she was psychotic, and that psychosis overwhelmed her ability to control her conduct. But the three prosecution witnesses on rebuttal had a very different opinion. The prosecution's expert, Dr. Mack, agreed that Lindsay had a mental disease or defect, but his position is that she still retained the capacity required for criminal responsibility. He sees major depression and anxiety, but not bipolar psychosis. He doesn't find it convincing evidence of delusions or a genuine psychotic process. And when he looks at January 24th, he sees behavior that is organized, purposeful, and goal-directed. He also points to evidence that Lindsay understood consequences. She had previously feared that if she disclosed thoughts of harming the children, they could be taken away. He interpreted statements like, go to God, her understanding that the children were innocent, and her later horror and shame as evidence that she understood the significance and wrongfulness of what she had done. And ultimately, Max said he saw nothing convincing him that whatever capacity Lindsay possessed before that evening suddenly disappeared when Patrick left the house. So Max's position is basically, yes, Lindsay was very mentally ill, but mental illness is not the same thing as legal insanity. Then we have Dr. Heilbrunn. Heilbrunn agrees with Resnick on bipolar 2, but not on the legal conclusion. In his opinion, Lindsay's illness did not destroy her ability to appreciate wrongfulness or conform her conduct to the law. And finally, Dr. Sethoff. And Sethoff may actually illustrate this distinction better than anyone, because he gives the defense quite a bit. He accepts that Lindsay had a mental disease or defect, he also diagnoses bipolar 2, and he recognizes how severely she was suffering. And yet, his ultimate conclusion is that Lindsay could still appreciate right from wrong and conform her behavior to the law. Why? Because when Sethoff reconstructs January 24th, he sees decision-making. He sees potential preparation in the 3V and CVS searches and the request that Patrick leave to run the errand. He sees an understanding that she had a limited amount of time while he was gone. And even if you accept that Lindsay heard a voice, Sethoff points out that according to her own account, the voice didn't tell her how to kill the children. She still had to make decisions about how to carry that out. He looks at the exercise bands as being available downstairs. He looks at the 534 phone call with Patrick and the fact that Lindsay could interrupt what she was doing, answer him, and interact without revealing what was happening. He considers the closed basement door and other actions as potential efforts to delay discovery or conceal what she had done. And he places all of that alongside her functioning earlier that day, like driving and taking Cora to the pediatrician, building the snowman, communicating with people, and caring for the children. And Sethoff makes another important point about the voice. Even if it was a genuine command hallucination, that doesn't automatically mean that Lindsay was incapable of resisting it. People can experience command hallucinations and still retain control over whether they obey them. So, Sethoff's conclusion is that Lindsay was seriously mentally ill and genuinely suicidal, but her behavior demonstrated that she could still make decisions, understand what she was doing, and control her actions. And I think after hours and hours and hours of expert testimony, this is where the disagreement has finally narrowed down. Ultimately, they're arguing about a very small window of time on January 24th. What was happening inside Lindsay Clancy's mind during those minutes? Was she a severely mentally ill and suicidal woman who was nevertheless making choices and retaining control over her actions? Or had her illness progressed into psychosis so severe that, as Resnick believes, she no longer had the substantial capacity to stop herself? That is the line that these experts are asking the jury to draw. We'll be right back.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And that brings us to what I think may be the hardest part of all of this. How is a jury supposed to decide which one of these experts is right? Because ultimately, they don't have to diagnose Lindsay themselves. And Lindsay doesn't have to prove that she was not criminally responsible. The burden belongs to the Commonwealth. Once lack of criminal responsibility is at issue, prosecutors have to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Lindsay was criminally responsible. So after hearing all four of these experts, the question isn't, which explanation do I like better? The question is, has the Commonwealth eliminated reasonable doubt about Lindsay's criminal responsibility? And credibility is going to matter enormously. Because look at the expert the defense gave them. Dr. Philip Bresnik has spent decades studying exactly the issues at the center of this case. Psychosis, malingering, and especially filicide, where a parent kills their child. He developed the five-category framework for understanding why parents kill children, and we heard about that in this trial. And what I found particularly significant is the Commonwealth's experts didn't come in here and tell this jury that Resnick is some fringe doctor with a bizarre theory. They know him. His work is known in this field. His research has been read and cited. Even the Commonwealth's experts acknowledged his expertise, including his work on filicide and malingering. Now, that doesn't mean that Resnick automatically wins. An expert can have extraordinary credentials and still be wrong about an individual case. But it absolutely gives the jury something to weigh. And prosecutors gave them reasons to question Resnick, too. They questioned whether his expertise in filicide could create its own kind of confirmation bias, whether someone who has spent decades studying psychotic and altruistic filicide might be more inclined to see this case through that lens. And that's a fair question, but then the defense turned that same question around on the Commonwealth's experts. What biases might they bring into this evaluation? Who retained them? What information did they have before meeting Lindsay? Did they begin forming opinions before they ever sat across from her? Who did they interview? And maybe just as importantly, who didn't they interview? And I don't want to gloss over the credentials on the Commonwealth side either. These weren't inexperienced witnesses. Mack is a psychiatrist with clinical and forensic experience. Heilbrunn is a forensic psychologist who has conducted forensic evaluations for both prosecutors and defendants and has testified hundreds of times. And Saithoff is a forensic psychiatrist with decades of experience evaluating defendants and consulting in major criminal cases. He's actually the head psychiatrist for the FBI in Quantico. But experience isn't interchangeable. Resnick's particular expertise is unusually specific to the issues in this case: filicide, psychosis, and malingering. Heilbrunn brings extensive forensic assessment and psychological testing experience, and Mack brings psychiatric experience. Saithoff brings decades of forensic psychiatry. So the jury isn't just deciding who has the longest resume. They're deciding whose expertise is most relevant to the question that they're being asked, and whose methodology they trust, and whose interpretation of Lindsay fits the evidence that they've heard. And then there's the timing. The Commonwealth's experts evaluated Lindsay years after January 24th of 2023. But Resnick evaluated her much closer to the killings, within months. And that doesn't automatically make his opinion correct either. The Commonwealth can argue that their experts had the benefit of substantially more records, testimony, and evidence. But the jury can also ask, who evaluated Lindsay closest in time to the mental state that we're actually trying to understand? That's a big deal. They can consider how much time each expert actually spent with her, whether they spoke with Patrick, Sue, her mother, her sister, or other people who watched her deteriorate, whether they relied primarily on records or also sought out the people who knew Lindsay before she became a criminal defendant. They can consider methodology, psychological testing, experience treating postpartum illness, which that ended up being quite an interesting topic too. The defense was really able to poke holes in the Commonwealth's experts on the last time that any of them actually had experience treating a woman with postpartum psychosis. And y'all, it's been a while. And all of that goes to weight. After weighing all of that, the jury still comes back to the same burden. Did the Commonwealth prove criminal responsibility beyond a reasonable doubt? And this is where, for me, the case looks very different than it did when this trial began. Because think back to what prosecutors told this jury in opening statements. I played a clip of it earlier. We were told that Lindsay was controlling, that after Patrick returned to work and she didn't have the same help anymore, the life that she thought she wanted became harder to control. And eventually, according to that opening theory, she didn't want that life anymore. She saw an opportunity to escape it and made a selfish choice to take that opportunity and take her children with her. We were also given the suggestion that this wasn't really a serious attempt to die. But now, all of the evidence is in. And what are the Commonwealth's own experts telling us? They're acknowledging serious mental illness. They're acknowledging genuine suicidality. They're treating what happened afterward as a real suicide attempt, including Safehoff describing it as very, very serious. And Heilbrunn himself gave an explanation for why Lindsay would take the children with her that is very different from just, yeah, she's selfish and done being a mother and she wants out. So that original theory has changed substantially. And I think the planning theory deserves the same scrutiny. Because, y'all, we've heard prosecutors repeatedly characterize the 3V and CVS errands as evidence that Lindsay deliberately created a window of time to kill the children. But saying something was part of a plan doesn't make it part of a plan. What does the actual evidence show? Lindsay looked up how far away 3V was, but she also gave an explanation for that. She didn't want Patrick gone for too long because she didn't want to be alone. She saw that it was only about 6 miles away, and they ordered from there. She even called ahead to make sure that the order would be ready when he got there. Is that something that she would do if she was trying to buy more time? Or would she wait a while before ordering it? Then CVS gets added to the trip. But that wasn't random. Cora had been to the pediatrician that day, and her doctor specifically recommended medication for her. And Lindsay didn't just tell Patrick, hey, stop at CVS, and send him wandering around looking for it. She called CVS first to make sure that they had it. And as Patrick was leaving, she texted him information about exactly what he needed to get. So if the purpose was to manufacture as much time alone as possible, why make the errand more efficient? That's something I struggle with. It just doesn't make sense. And there's another question. Why this tiny window? Patrick had been away from the house before. He went to brunch. He went out with friends. There were other periods when Lindsay had access to the children without him standing beside her. He even worked for long stretches in the basement while Lindsay and the children were elsewhere in the house. If this was a calculated plan that she had been developing, why wait for this incredibly narrow, unpredictable window created by a takeout order and medicine for a sick child? Maybe prosecutors have an answer for that. But they have the burden of proof. The same thing happens when I look at motive. The Commonwealth began this case telling us about a selfish mother who wanted out. But witness after witness, including witnesses called by the prosecution, described Lindsay as a loving, attentive, involved mother. Now, that doesn't mean a loving mother can't kill her children. Obviously, tragically, we know that that happened. But the question is why? When the Commonwealth's own experts are acknowledging severe mental illness, genuine suicidality, a genuine attempt to die, and an explanation for taking the children with her that involves her attachment to them rather than just wanting to escape them, I think it's fair to ask the question, what happened to the theory that we started this trial with? Because the Commonwealth doesn't get to prove its case simply by offering a possible interpretation of the evidence. It has to prove criminal responsibility beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's where Dr. Resnick's testimony becomes so important. Whether the jury ultimately accepts every part of it or not. The jury doesn't necessarily have to decide whether or not Dr. Resnick is right. They have to decide whether the Commonwealth has proven, beyond a reasonable doubt, that he is wrong about the thing that matters legally. Because if, after considering everything, the jury believes that Resnick's explanation is reasonably possible, then that is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That is reasonable doubt. And now that every witness has testified and all of the evidence is finally on the table, I think that's the question we're left with. Not whether the Commonwealth has presented a theory of what happened, but whether they have proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. So now, all that's left is argument and a decision. In the next episode, we'll go through the closing arguments, where each side gets one final opportunity to take all of the pieces and tell the jury what they believe the evidence actually proved. What will prosecutors do with a case that looks different now than it did in opening statements? How will the defense bring weeks of evidence back to that question of criminal responsibility? And which pieces of testimony will each side ask this jury to carry with them into deliberations? Then we'll break down the jury instructions, because after everything we've heard, the jurors will finally be told exactly what Massachusetts law requires them to decide, and what the Commonwealth must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And then there will be nothing left to present. No more witnesses, no more experts, no more arguments. Just 12 jurors, the evidence, the law, and eventually, a verdict. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. It helps more listeners discover the podcast. And if you know someone who would find this case as fascinating as you did, share this episode with them. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.